Hello, and thank you for joining this HCP Live Medcast series, Real World Treatment Strategies Using Next Generation Therapies for Neovascular AMD and DME. My name is Dr. Hassan Rahimi. I'm a retina specialist in the San Francisco Bay Area.
My name is Dr. David Miller with Retina Associates at Cleveland in Cleveland, Ohio.
In this episode, we focus on real world treatment strategies for managing neovascular AMD and DME with newer, more durable anti-VEGF therapies. We will share insights on applying clinical trial protocols in everyday practice, optimizing loading and extension strategies, and identifying patients who may benefit the most from these therapies. Joining us in this discussion today is my good friend, Dr. Michael Kloufis. Michael, welcome today.
Thanks for having me, Hassan. As you know, I'm a native East Coaster, but made my way to Los Angeles for my fellowship and then came back to the East Coast to join the job at Mid-Atlantic Retina, Will's Eye, and been here for 9 wonderful years. And it's been a really great experience and happy to be here tonight.
Excellent. Well, Mike, again, thank you for joining us. Let's just kind of dive right in. I'd like to start with a little bit of a sort of a philosophical question, if you will. We see a lot of real-world data studies these days in our field. How does real-world data better enhance our understanding of overall treatment effectiveness beyond just what we get from clinical trials with all these various treatments we have?
Yeah, very good question. And thanks for all your work with some of the large databases that I know Stanford and their affiliates have access to. So I think, we've been instructed by many different situations. For instance, look at pegcetacoplan. We had thousands of patients in the clinical trial. The sister drug actually had less patients in the clinical trial. And then once we had real-world use with, 50,000 plus injections, we started noticing some additional side effects. So I think for us, safety, first and foremost, is very helpful from seeing these real-world studies. And then, we have to remember in neovascular AMD, especially LUCERNE, TENAYA, and PULSAR study, these were all treatment-naive neovascular AMD. And so a lot of us in the real world, when we get a new agent available to us for retinal vascular disease, we actually use it in our previously treated patients. So, for instance, something like aflibercept 8 milligrams, in my personal practice, a lot of my 2 milligram patients were actually switched to 8 milligram, but the registry trial doesn't really address that clinical situation. And that's probably a practice pattern that's been widely adopted by many around the country, switching, for instance, from 2 milligram to 8 milligram. But, in a major clinical trial, we would technically reload all the patients. That may be not what we're doing in the real world. So I think all these different scenarios can instruct us. And especially when I have a new agent available to me, many patients will ask, well, I don't want to try something new. You can tell them, well, there are about, 1,000, 2,000 patients in the major phase III trials. But, after a couple months of use, if we have real-world data from databases, et cetera, we can give them more clarity as to how many doses have administered and how safe that product is compared to what we've had in the past as well.
Very well said. David, for you, I mean, what challenges have you faced in your practice when applying trial-based protocols to your everyday practice?
Well, I think Michael had a really good point there. When you get to the real world, the first patients my partners jump to, there's like 15 of them, they almost all jump to the patients that were not doing well on the other agents, right? So you're taking hard to treat cases, the recalcitrant cases, and putting them on the new therapy. And that's not addressed at all in the clinical trials, right? And so there's a need for that data to help guide us. And then, of course, the clinical trials are nice guides. They help guide us along, maybe give us some confidence to extend patients out even when there may be a little fluid or a small drop in vision between visits. And that's where it can be really nice to have the intersection of the real world and the clinical trials to try and modify what you can attempt in the real world with some confidence.
Michael, you touched on this earlier. We kind of like expound on it a little bit, but let's say you're dealing with a treatment naive patient, whether it's faricimab or aflibercept 8 milligrams. And how closely are you following the recommended loading dose schedules and really like, staying on label as per how frequently they treated in the trials in your practice, assuming it's a treatment naive patient?
Yes, I think that in the beginning, for sure, we want to maximize vision gains. So one thing I personally do is I'm always asking the patient, we know we can't make the vision perfect, but How close is it to baseline, so we can maximize that runway? There are cases of neovascular AMD we pick up early with 20/25 vision and a sliver of fluid. We may be maximizing vision after one loading dose, and it may be appropriate to extend sooner. However, the case that's 20/80 with a pigment epithelial detachment, and you get a 20% improvement in fluid, but the vision is still 20/70 after 4 weeks, I'll probably continue loading that patient per the trial, or even go beyond the trial if it requires more intensive therapy, whether that be continuing with the label or using an alternative agent if it needs to be administered more frequently. So I think that's where the art of medicine comes into play, or the art of retina. We have to use the clinical trial data as a guideline and the label the FDA provides, but we also have to treat that patient to the best of our ability. But I'll go both ways, staying on label with the full loading doses, whether that's three or four loading doses in neovascular AMD, sometimes five in some DME protocols, or early extension when there's complete resolution of disease. I mean, if we look back to clinical trials like Harbor, we know the average treatment interval is about 10 weeks for neovascular AMD. We know some patients can even go PRN, and I'm eager to integrate things like OCTA, et cetera, in my practice to help guide my treatment paradigm, or maybe even stopping treatment in some cases.
Very well said. Is your approach any different if you're dealing with a treatment experienced patient and now you're switching therapies onto faricimab or 8 milligrams? Are you trying to exhaust those loading doses there too, or are you really trying to just get them at least to what the injection interval was previously, if not another week or two longer, and go from there?
I would say on the switch, I'm pretty content to try and extend out early, not have to go through the loading doses. I would say on someone who's treatment naive, maybe the loading doses seem a little more appropriate to me. Still, I'm always a little cautious if I'm using a aflibercept because of the 4 to 8 week jump. I do like to try and get that one injection in before at 5 or 6, so I'm not trying to go out. I guess you can go a week early at 7, but my point being, not trying to make a 4 week jump.
Is the loading dose strategy different for each of you based on the disease you're treating, or whether it's wet AMD or DME, or is it more, patient-specific factors that would dictate that?
I'll let Michael go first, but I would just say, the wet AMD certainly is more concerning. Michael.
I agree with David. In DME, a lot of the prior protocols seem to suggest that with almost every agent except for off-label bevacizumab, we're going to get close to the same vision, especially at end of year one or definitely by year two. So I think the treatment paradigm has really shifted to quicker return of vision, and quicker resolution of fluid and more durability. And so I think given where we may end up and where the vision starts, you might have a little more flexibility with diabetic macular edema. That being said, if I have a patient who has a commercial driver's license CDL and they're 20/60, I'm probably going to be treating them quite aggressively so they can maintain their job. Or it might be a surgeon who's a long duration diabetic and they're not having the finest vision to do procedures, et cetera. It really got to base it on the visual demands. I think we've moved a lot towards OCT, but I still like to have vision as a metric, even though it's mostly Snellen and not ETDRS. But I know, Hassan, you've worked on some mobile apps to have a surrogate for ETDRS vision. So it'd be great to have a more standardized vision or best corrected vision available to us in the clinic to guide our treatment.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Currently, the way we're just so reliant on our technicians obtaining Snellen acuity, and as we know, it's just so variable visit to visit. Patients forget their glasses, they have dry eye, some techs push harder than other techs, and so I think that's why our field's really so reliant on the anatomy. We joke oftentimes we're OCT cosmetologists, but that's really our true reproducible biomarker, right? It's just to see how it responds from visit to visit. And to your point, Michael, it's such a gap in terms of information that I think our field needs to provide better care to our patients is how they do between those visits, whether it's testing their functional vision with at-home testing apps or devices, or even, the advent of home or portable OCT, which we know is kind of around the corner. I think once that comes on board and we're able to get more nuanced information in terms of how our patient's disease may fluctuate and, you know, have variability on an hour to hour, day to day basis, like we have no idea about these things right now, right? I think that can be a potentially an exponential phase of learning for our field and advancement. I certainly look forward to it. I think we all agree we're on the cusp of that becoming readily available. Sort of in line with that, because, you know, I know a number of these studies, the ones we're referring to with faricimab and high dose of aflibercept, as well as a lot of the other methods that are being explored for sustained drug delivery, are looking at ways to like really extend out treatment intervals. So in clinical trials, at least for faricimab and high dose of aflibercept, they were using 4-week intervals. And I think clinically speaking, when we talk to a lot of our colleagues, that's very disruptive. It's like, it's paradigm shifting. I know a lot of colleagues aren't comfortable with that. A lot of us trained with 1-2 week extensions. How comfortable are each of you with this idea of trusting in the durability of these drugs and going out and taking some of these patients out 4 weeks without seeing them and having them come back? Michael, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I think it's the next sort of phase of treat and extend. I think a lot of us are accustomed to 1-2 week intervals. It also depends on how many clinic locations you go to, how often you're at that clinic. These things all factor in. And I think, you know, our worry is vision loss, potentially hemorrhage in neovascular AMD or detecting fluid prior to the onset of hemorrhage. So I think a good way to try to integrate this, and this is what I've done over the past 6 to 12 months, is in diabetic macular edema, I'm much more willing to extend by 4 weeks. In neovascular AMD and a monocular patient, I think 1-2 week extension may be superior given, number one, the patient's depending on vision in that eye. Nothing is lost by slight overtreatment, and a lot can be lost by undertreatment or hemorrhage. Especially in a one-eyed patient. And I think there's also this notion between the patient and the doctor, they may want to be monitored more carefully. Another approach I've thought of is, you know, maybe you see them back in 2 weeks, and if they're willing to come in for an initial visit, you may withhold the injection at that 2-week interval and then extend by another 2 weeks and plan to treat at that 4-week interval to make both parties feel most comfortable with that 4-week extension as an intermediary to getting to those average 4-week extensions in the future.
I would agree. I think Michael stated that very, very well with all the nuances between being a monocular patient or how often you're at an office, et cetera, how those things can weigh in. But all that's taken into consideration. And certainly with the wet AMD patients, a little more cautious than the diabetic maculopathy patients on these treatment intervals. We have to be a little more concerned, of course, in the neovascular AMD that if something goes wrong, it's going to stay wrong. Whereas in the DME patients, of course, we have some ground to give because we can typically regain it quite well.
Yeah, I'm with both of you. I think for me, I've been much more willing to explore and challenge again the old paradigm by doing 4-week extensions on DME, and by and large, I've been, you know, quite pleasantly surprised. I think with all of our wet AMD patients, you said it beautifully, Michael. It's just like over treatment, I see less downside risk to under treatment. All it takes is one bad hemorrhage and it's game over for some of these patients. So I still go in my, depending on the patient and their fellow eye status, 1-2 week extension. And, you know, I think a lot of these patients really still appreciate that. One thing I wasn't expecting when these extended durability drugs became available is, you know, I kind of just assumed everybody would be thrilled. Like they want to go 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever. And I was surprised at the subset of my practice, much greater than I had expected, that didn't want it. Not that they didn't want the drugs. They weren't comfortable with going much longer. Like it's like they were already educated and programmed that the patients who do the best long-term are those that get more frequent treatments, that adhere to their treatment regimen, that come in frequently. And now that these newer drugs are available, they were excited to have them. But a couple of patients verbalized to me, they said, I like this as a security blanket. This is a safety blanket. I really appreciate the extended durability. And sure, we can extend a couple of weeks out, but I'm not necessarily trying to come in half as often or a third as often. Do you deal with patients like that? Michael, have you had these in your practice as well too?
Absolutely. I mean, the most common scenario I encounter that is, a patient may be dry at 6 weeks with neovascular AMD on any agent, and you say, "Hey, let's go for 8 weeks." And what I'll hear verbalized is my vision starts to decline close to the visit. And I believe it. I mean, we know that this is a recurrent disease that tends to come back even with intermittent treatment. But we just don't see the exudation quite yet on OCT, but it may be coming in a day, two, three. I think in retinal vein occlusion, we see this very timed much better, like a Swiss watch. It's on time and it's going to come back at 6 weeks and 2 days, and if the patient's a couple days late, the macular edema returns. But I think there is a similar phenomenon in some of our more frequent neovascular AMD patients as well. And I always tell the patient, "Look, I'm going to be here. So if you prefer 6 weeks and you don't want to go eight, that's fine." Sometimes, if it's every 2 week clinic, what I compromise with is, "Hey, I think you can alternate between 6 and 8 weeks to get an average treatment interval of 7 weeks to reduce the treatment burden. I'll integrate that sometimes, or give them sort of a holiday if they have a family event or some other conflict." But those are measures I've taken in my clinic. But I do agree that every single study we've seen in the past with more frequent treatment shows these marginal gains in the order of like 1 to 3 letters. And I think some of our patients with very good vision or one eye are depending on that marginal gain, and it may be appropriate to treat them more frequently than what the OCT suggests.
Excellent. Yes.
Those are good points. And I would just add, Isan, that the vast majority of my patients are happy to take the advice to go out 2 or 4 weeks longer. But there are those, you're right. It's a minority. They stick to their guns, and I'm not going to push back too hard, because of what we're talking here. It's not that difficult for me to see them and give one extra shot that maybe I'm thinking this could have waited a month. But at the same time, I don't want to be on the other side of the argument if something goes wrong. And, things can often go wrong. Maybe it's not that month, but maybe it's 2 years later, right? So if the patients are really stuck on that, like you said, they want to come in at that interval and keep that interval, and they're kind of pointing at me, I'm like, hey, no problem, right? Let's just keep it going, right?
So on one hand, the way in these next generation agents like faricimab and 8 milligram aflibercept, I think have challenged the way we've done things is, as we touched on, is okay, what amount of an extension interval are we comfortable doing? Like whether it's 1, 2, 4 weeks at a time. I think the second aspect becomes how far out are we now comfortable extending? Like if you think about your entire injection practice sort of as this bimodal curve, if you will, I envision introducing these agents into our practice probably did, we hope, two things. One is probably shift the balance of the curve more toward the right, whereas, if you were previously centered around 8 weeks or so, which I think, Iris Registry database study has shown us on average, that's what patients' injection intervals are. Maybe we get closer to 9, 10, 11 weeks. So we get like a right shift on the curve. But also the tail end of that curve potentially goes longer than maybe where our field was previously comfortable. And, Mike and I trained around the same time. I remember back then, a lot of docs, a lot of our field would cite 10 weeks as a cap on extension. Over time, that switched to 12 weeks. I remember we all went through COVID, and you know what? It wasn't the patients that got recurrent disease that were challenging that appeared a year later. It was the people who came back a year later and nothing had changed. And they were the ones really challenging this dictum of like, why am I doing 12 weeks? I want to go longer. And I talked to a lot of colleagues like post-COVID, we're just becoming comfortable in some cases going 14 weeks, 16 weeks. Where are you guys at with that? Like what is your cap for extension with first generation agents, but really more for the sake of this conversation with agents like faricimab and 8 milligram aflibercept?
Sure, I'll go first on this. I guess you stated it really well. I remember the cap kind of being 12 weeks, and then came the long duration agents, the new agents, and with that data out there showing 88% of patients maintaining their Q16 week interval or something like that with not losing more than not meeting the criteria to drop down to a more frequent interval. And those were probably a little looser criteria than I've used in clinical practice, but still non-inferior, certainly gave me more confidence just looking at those two clinical trials that go out to the Q12, 14, and 16 weeks. And currently, I do have a lot of patients floating around at that Q16 week mark. I can't say I've really done a whole lot of Q20, Q24. I start wondering if I need the drug that much at that point. You know, if I'm going to withdraw the medication from someone, maybe it's that type of patient. Or like you mentioned, the one that's lost for half a year or more and comes back in and looks rock solid. Not sure I'm going to restart the therapy right away as opposed to just checking them more frequently. So that would be kind of my approach. And that's probably how these drugs have altered my practice most impactfully, both of them, the aflibercept 8 milligrams and the faricimab, to make me feel more confident with the data they had for those longer intervals. Michael, do you have any thoughts along those lines too?
Well, you know, what comes to mind first is with the aflibercept 2 milligram dosing registry studies. You know, initially there was a 12-week label, but the vision was slightly inferior at 12 weeks. And so, you know, it had a caveat in there that, you know, aflibercept 2 milligrams should be administered monthly for the load, and then every 8 weeks may be administered monthly with no additional visual or anatomic benefits, and slightly inferior vision at 12 weeks. Fast forward about, you know, 7 to 10 years, and now we're in, you know, 3-year data for aflibercept 8 milligram, and, you know, 3 to 4 year data with Rhone-X with faricimab as well. And, you know, we're seeing similar visual acuity gains, maybe a slight decline. So I've always kept it in the back of my mind, at least year one and year two data compared to fixed interval aflibercept 2 milligrams every 8 weeks in neovascular AMD. There's a non-statistically significant difference in vision when we offer extension with faricimab, for instance, or aflibercept 8 milligrams. But, you know, having been in practice almost a decade now, these patients stick with you a lot longer. So I definitely want to have further confidence that there's not a decline in vision with these extended dosing intervals over 3, 5, 7 year periods of time, because I think that's where the rubber really hits the road for us clinically in our with our patients, because vision is king or queen at the end of the day. Patients want to see. And people wonder why the retina clinic's so busy. Well, when people stop therapy, their vision typically goes and they come back in, even though they have other demands or loss to follow-up issues. So, you know, in DME though, I think we see the disease recede over time. And so I've started to integrate 20-week treatment now with my diabetic macular edema patients. Oftentimes their A1C is under control, one eye has become quiescent, I may stop treatment there. They have a little residual edema in the other eye, but the vision's quite good. And I'm going 16, 20 weeks. I haven't done 24 weeks quite yet. Neovascular AMD, I think some of these CNVs don't need as frequent treatment, but it's hard for me to ascertain from OCT alone, you know, what's safe to go 16, 20, or 24 weeks. But you know, nevertheless, with these 3-year extension studies with aflibercept 8 milligrams, for instance, about 50% go 20 weeks and 24% go 24 weeks in both neovascular AMD and diabetic macular edema. So I think that's quite impressive. Faricimab, they didn't allow that type of extension past 16 weeks. You know, it's just more data to support potentially further extension in appropriate patients.
Yeah, Michael, you've done actually a lot of great work and research with Susvimo, with the port delivery system. And, you know, part of this process is treatment schedules, but the other part is monitoring schedules, right? There's office visit burden potentially at play here too, coming in, waiting, getting imaging, testing, et cetera. I mean, how do you reconcile that with your experience with port delivery system now integrating these you know, sustained, disease control agents like faricimab and 8 milligram into your practice, where, you know, ideally we're trying to space out visits, but we're losing the ability to monitor for recurrence, as you said, because we don't have great biomarkers to know who these particular patients are. Do you have any tips on that? Like, do you bring patients in? Do you do home monitoring? Or where do you see this headed to get the field more comfortable with the idea of potentially 24-week extension? Because I agree with what you guys said. I'm not there yet with wet AMD.
I agree. I mean, in neovascular AMD, we know the longer the patient's around, you know, the lifetime risk of conversion in the fellow eye might be 25% or higher, or, you know, whatever rate you want to use per year. And it depends on the patient age. So the easiest scenario is like a patient I saw today. She was in the Archway study and received PDS, Susvimo in one eye. Her other eye converted. She received two injections. It was not commercially approved. I said, either you're going to go into a Genentech Roche clinical trial with the port delivery in the other eye, if that's your wish, or we'll do it commercially. She ended up getting it commercially. Now she has port delivery or Susvimo in both eyes. So she has sustained delivery, and it mitigates the monitoring problem. However, I agree. I think that, you know, a lot of people don't have it in the other eye, and that may be their better seeing eye. And I think Amsler grid in 2025 is not an excellent surrogate. So, you know, it'd be great if something like the port delivery platform could be refilled as soon as 4 months, because I think 3 times a year is super safe monitoring. Depending if they're seeing another eye care provider who may be doing an OCT or looking for vision or hemorrhage, you know, they may not need to see me that frequently. But I agree, when you get to the 6 month mark, it's a little problematic, to monitor the fellow eye, especially if you want to have extreme vigilance. We know we have newer home OCTs. It just seems like the reimbursement's not quite there, and who's going to monitor all these reports. So, I'd be very eager to integrate something like this into my clinical practice as I'm trying to get to a 20 or 24 week extension.
And another challenge, I don't think, verbalized, not beyond just the inability to monitor for disease recurrence at such long treatment intervals. I had a suspicion that compliance actually falls off when you go too far out. And we looked at that internally, and I'm sure, I don't know if you guys can corroborate this with your own practices, but especially with diabetic patients, once I started extending beyond 4 months, compliance falls off a cliff. And I don't know if that's just because, you know, it's easy to like miss that appointment. You have other things going on as a patient. Maybe you don't prioritize something just psychologically if you don't have it as frequently. But really, it looks like the sweet spot is right around 3 months, max 4 months. And I've actually started to like scale it back. Whereas in the beginning, I was quite eager to say, let's try 20 weeks and 24 weeks. And now I'm finding out a lot of these patients haven't come back, or they come back with a vitreous hemorrhage or something a year later. I'm knowing that tightening it down a little bit, while again, the patients are enthusiastic that the durability is there in case real world happens, real life happens, they get hospitalized, they have surgery, they have to miss an appointment, so that we're not losing our gains. Have you guys seen something similar in your practices as well?
Absolutely.
You know,
go ahead, David.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Yeah, I'd say absolutely. I think you're right. When you start getting out to 6 months, especially in the eyes that you were treating actively, or, you know, treating off and on, those patients, that patient personality, the reason they, you know, they kind of got into that situation to start with, you know, maybe a little self neglect there in their diabetic management, they kind of, I think, lose track of the importance of coming in. Right. And I think you're right. The 3 or 4 month intervals, kind of the sweet spot for some of them. And so to get out the 6 months, I got to be really comfortable that they probably don't need to come at 6 months either. You know, like I'm at that point, I'm almost thinking there's just really going to be nothing going on. You're right.
Yeah. It's very insightful what you say, because essentially, you know, we're trying to say a Goldilocks story to our kids. You know, we don't want the porridge too hot or the porridge too cold. And that's what we're struggling with as doctors. You know, I just recall starting off, you know, I was maybe a little too liberal with extension, and then I reverted to like, you know, more monthly treatment, and that was too much. And you're trying to find Goldilocks in the middle. And it's a very difficult thing to find. And we all want that perfect temperature food that's not going to burn your mouth and also not going to be cold and not tasteful. And that's what we're trying to do for our patients. And it's a hard thing to find. And I think that we'll see if we can get this extension a little longer with these newer agents, or if we need to be more 3, 4 months, regardless of the clinical trial data.
Well said. I joke when I give some of these lectures, we have big data. Like, I've done a lot of big data studies, aggregate EHR type studies, you have clinical trial data, and then you have institutional data. Then you have like Wills and Mid-Atlantic retina data, which is, it is institutional, but it's basically on the level of big data, given the sheer volume and number of patients that you guys collectively take care of. Tell us a little, because you guys have obviously looked at your own data there, Michael. Like, generally speaking, what are we seeing in the real world in terms of average extension? Like, when we put a patient on existing therapy and they go on to faricimab and even like 8 milligram aflibercept, you know, in general, how many added weeks are we adding to this patient for their treatment duration?
Yeah, for me personally, my 2 milligram aflibercept patients, what I described to them is if we're going to switch to 8 milligram, we should expect likely better disease control and extension on the order of 2 to 4 weeks. We can't guarantee it, but it's worth a try. I think on average, it's 3 to 4 weeks is what I'm seeing. So if someone was at 8 weeks, I'm pretty confident they're going to get to 10 to 12. Sometimes we get lucky and they can go a little bit longer. I think the other thing is we see the extension typically get better over time from clinical trial and real world. So even if the extension doesn't happen right away, but it happens 6 months or a year later, that is a good thing to caution the patient on. And we want to get there slowly and safely. It's not a race. Like Omesh Gupta told me once in a while, I said, Omesh, you did all these cases. He's like, Mike, it's not a race. Same thing with extension. It's not a race. We'll get there, whether it's this year or next year. It's going to happen for you, and it's going to get better over time.
Very well said.
That's very insightful. I agree. And I would say that when you look at the treatment intervals there for aflibercept 2 milligrams on average, maybe it was 8 to 10 weeks. And I would say by going to the 8 milligram dose, I think you're adding on average maybe 2 to 3 weeks. It's kind of interesting because the patients, it's kind of hard sometimes to say for certain because some of the patients are the ones you can't get past 4 or 6, right? And you put them on the 8 milligrams and you're instantly going right out to 8 and then 12. So some of those are dramatic gains, but you don't know exactly what would have happened if you stayed on the 2 milligram, et cetera. But you do have the kind of the low-hanging fruit for patients to switch are the ones where you're sitting there at Q6 week intervals on a 2 milligram dose of aflibercept, right? And quite often you get more than 2 weeks on that as an additional benefit.
Excellent. I think we're coming in the home stretch. I'd like to end on a fun topic, forward looking. Where are we headed? So, Michael, looking ahead, I mean, what are emerging therapies or different drug delivery strategies that have you most excited about in terms of reducing treatment burden for our patients with exudative diseases?
I think gene therapy, probably vitrectomy with subretinal injection, is probably hopefully going to be another gene therapy that's approved in the ophthalmology space. I think obviously the Holy Grail is having some sort of intravitreal or suprachoroidal injection in the clinic. So I'm eager to see those. And I think what we really need too is a better treatment for geographic atrophy. I mean, we're looking at oral therapies, daily or monthly subcutaneous therapies, whether it's anti-complement or another biologic pathway. But I think that's a huge unmet need for us because we know patients lose vision from progressive GA. And I think the current treatments are just, mildly effective, but still popular among a subset of patients.
David, how about yourself? What are you looking forward to?
I would echo Michael's comments. I think the gene therapy, the subretinal injection in particular, looks quite promising with the data. And maybe the suprachoroidal delivery for the diabetics, maybe that can work there too. I'm a little less optimistic maybe on the intravitreal, but we'll see. And then when it comes to the complement therapy, anything there that we can get longer duration in particular, I think those drugs, seem to be gaining momentum when you get out multiple years. But it'd be nice to be not quite the treatment burden for those patients. So anything that can, push that out, like we've seen with the newer anti-VEGF agents, would be much appreciated.
Yeah, and I'll throw this out there too. Gene therapy, suprachoroidal drug delivery. I'm also excited to see what we get out of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors as well too. I think if you think of this potential for one and done in terms of like efficacy, disease control long-term, that's phenomenal, right? But there's always a trade-off here and your threshold for long-term safety, potential risk for inflammation, what are costs associated with these? I almost look at these TKIs as potentially being a balance, if you will, between like the old world and the new in terms of where we want to ideally head. They'll still be administered as injections. They'd be in the clinic, potentially in a 6 to 12 month interval, can potentially work together synergistically with the injections that we currently administer. I'm excited to see how those phase 3 trials progress, which they're ongoing as well now. So I think, at the end of the day, we have a lot of shots on goal in our field. We're very fortunate to have what we do currently. Our patients are very fortunate, but hopefully things are always, as I tell our patients, just getting better. They're you never want to have wet macular degeneration or diabetic macular edema, but there's no better time to have it than right now. And I think a lot of our patients truly appreciate that. Michael, thank you for joining us today. This has been a fantastic conversation with both you and David. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you for our next episode. Thanks again, everybody.